So last week we had the first opening lecture, and it was a fairly rich in at least in the topics that we covered. We talked about predestination, obedience, mercy, a very rich concept. We talked about hope, the fear of the Lord, and priesthood. And today is a very short section. But we're moving into one of the key, perhaps the key topic of this whole letter, which concerns suffering. But before we do that, we got to chapter 2, and we're beginning with verse 11. This is part 2 of the letter, and Peter is appealing to the Christians in Asia Minor to live as disciples of Jesus, but to live in the world. He's not asking them to leave the world, of course. He's asking them to live there, but to live as disciples. And the first point he makes in verses 11 to 12, which I'll just read for you, is he wants them to show the error of the accusations that are being made against them by living beautifully Christian lives, and not give any grounds for accusation to the pagans around them or the Jews around them that are jealous of what they're doing or against what they're doing. So he says here, "Beloved, I urge you." And as with Paul, this is a rare word. It's not the normal word used, at least in the Hellenistic Greek world, for moral exhortation. This is the verb in Greek, parakaleo. Kaleo, exactly the same word we get our word call from it. Etymologically, they're cognate. So, and para is alongside. So when Peter, as with Paul, is urging people to behave well, he's calling them to do it. So it's a very beautiful insight. He's not putting it on top of people. He's calling out from them. It's a bit like our word education, isn't it? Educare, to call forth, to draw forth. He's calling forth for them, but he's not doing the calling. It's parakaleo. Jesus is the one calling them, and Paul, on Jesus' behalf, as an ambassador, is calling them to live well. I urge you, as aliens and exiles, people not at home in the world and its values that they've left, the values, and he says, to abstain from the desires of the flesh that wage against the soul. Desires of the flesh we might, unfortunately, quickly associate with sexual desires. That's not the point he's making. It includes that. But the flesh is our human nature not open to the Spirit. So it's any pride is a desire of the flesh. Envy is a desire of the flesh. Sexual misconduct also, of course. But the flesh is our whole human nature, the human condition that is not open to grace. So abstain from the desires of the flesh that wage war against the soul. Conduct yourselves honorably among the Gentiles, so that though they malign you as evildoers, and they are doing that, they may see your honorable deeds and glorify God when he comes to judge. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? And clear and quite beautiful. The same as Jesus said, let your deeds be such that they will give glory to your Father in heaven. Not glory to the person doing the good deeds. We're not interested in getting glorified. But if we're presenting ourselves as disciples of Jesus, then let our behaviour reflect who Jesus is, lest people can then think, well, if that's what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, it's a negative value, and they kind of put Jesus down as well. Then he goes to a really simple, once put in context, but it does need some qualification, some analysis, a bit careful, I would think. He goes to a second point here in verses 13 to 17, because one of the problems, which I'm sure I mentioned last week, and you'll see it, in their world, that world of Asia Minor, they are not taking part in a lot of civil or civic life. because it involves honouring the emperor, worshipping at the shrines. It's the whole society is geared to a way that is not open to the freedom of people or the beauty of people, the way Jesus showed it. And a lot of it is to do with kowtowing to the emperor and his people in there to win favour. This is nothing new, and by the way, we've still got the danger in our world as well, kowtowing to the economic powers that kind of may run our world if we let them. So here, Peter is telling them, there is such a thing as civil obedience. He doesn't want them to be anti-society or anti-good order or anti-government. So he's asking them to be good citizens. Their moral behaviour has to be good, but be good citizens too. Contribute to the town and the city and its life. But there are lovely qualifications on it. So he says, firstly, for the Lord's sake. So it's for the sake, because of your faith, he says, accept the authority of every human institution, whether of the emperor as supreme or of governors as sent by the emperor to punish those who do wrong and to praise those who do right. Let's look at that really carefully. I hope you'd agree it's very wise advice. But it's also got some very important qualifications in it. Notice, firstly, he doesn't say the authority is instituted by God, which it would claim. The emperor is divine, divus Caesar, you know. And this is all coming from the gods. Peter is saying, no, it's a human institution. Keep it in its place. That's one important qualification. The second thing is the assumption behind the obedience which he's asking of them. He's not saying, accept the authority of every human institution, punt, finish, end. The assumption is that they are sent to punish those who do wrong and praise those who do right. In brackets, if a government is not punishing those who do wrong, but punishing those who do right, and if a government is upholding those who do evil, well, it loses its credibility and it loses its power and you don't obey it. Surely that's in brackets there. It's an assumption here that this is the kind of government I'm talking about, and it's a good assumption. We ought to start with that presumption that it is and be good citizens. It's only when it's clearly not doing that that we might have to disobey, and as you well know. For he goes on, for it is God's will that by doing right you should silence the ignorance of the foolish. Clearly they are being accused by people around them of being anti-government, anti-institution, anti-society. He wants them to bend over backwards to show that that is not the case. He doesn't want them to pull out of society. He wants to be engaged in it and not withdraw into a sectarian isolation or be known to be anti-emperor or anti-governor, just to be so. Verse 16, as slaves of God. Remember Jesus' words, you can only have one master. You either hate the one and love the other or whatever. So you cannot serve God and mammon, says Jesus. So if they're slaves of God, there's another beautiful, important element of this teaching. Your obedience is owed ultimately with all your heart, mind, soul and strength to God, to the sacred. So that underlies all of this. And if obedience to the governor means non-obedience to the mystery that we call God, well, they'll have to do what they are doing, accept martyrdom rather than that, which of course they did. Some of them did. As slaves of God, live as free people. Yet, do not use your freedom as a pretext for evil, the evil of being insubordinate, civil insubordination, anti-institution, just for its own sake. Here's Paul to the Galatians. You were called to freedom, brothers and sisters. Do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, is the word he uses, same word we had above, self-indulgence, translated here. But through love, become slaves one to another. So, honour everyone, love the family of believers. I think that's open to a better translation there. I don't want to take you through all the fine points of Greek, but it's a present imperative. And the fact is, the Greek scholars tell me that the aorist imperative is the simple form in Greek, and that's certainly true. And normally the aorist imperative is the aoristo, without horizon, without nuance. The aorist imperative simply tells you, when you move into the present imperative, for those of you interested in language, then there's a nuance there that you need to discover. There's a reason for using present rather than aorist. And the most obvious reason here, I would translate it, go on loving in your present moment. Continually love. Keep on loving. Go on loving the family of believers. Go on fearing God. Go on honouring the emperor. Continue honouring the emperor. Give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, says Jesus, and to God the things that are God. So that's a bit quick, but I didn't want to spend much time on it. I just hope it's clear enough to you. Don't take it, as some have taken it, as a carte blanche to be obedient. All those qualifications are terribly important. It's for the Lord's sake. It's recognizing the human nature of the institution. It's assuming that it's there to do good, which is a good assumption. If proved contrary, then we must disobey it. And they did, of course. But he didn't want them to be known as a group that was anti the institution, anti-society. He then moves to another issue, which is that concerning slaves, and that will take us, I'll read it first and then we'll look at the text that might help us in our understanding of it. Verse 18 reads, slaves, accept the authority of your masters with all, now my translation says deference. Is yours a bit similar? At least the New Revised Standard Version has with all deference.
Respect.
Okay. So they've all tried to get at the heart of it. I think we have to go a bit deeper to get to the heart of it. The Greek is phobos. Now that is the word used earlier here in the last section we did. Phobos theou is fear of the Lord. It's the same word. It needn't be this, but in the context, I think he's not talking about deference to their master. He's talking about doing it in fear of the Lord. Now I spoke about that last week, and I want to do it again now. But it's not deference to the master. It's reverence towards God. So that again puts a qualification on this deference to the master. It's because of their response to God that he's asking them as slaves, and he's not there to change the whole society. How on earth could Peter expect to do that? One day we might look back at our system of employers and employees and think, how could people ever have lived like that? We take it for granted. We don't set up an institution to get rid of all employees and have every one of those employers. It's kind of unthinkable in our system. Well, for them, slavery in Corinth, I remember telling you, 2/3 of the population were slaves. That's the normal population of the city. There was something like 300,000 population estimated at the time, of whom 200,000 were slaves. So that's the system we're talking about. Slaves doesn't mean people dragged from somewhere in chains. Well, I'm sorry, perhaps it does mean that. It was basically people who lost a battle and would then be brought in, and they would be part of the family, and they would do the domestic slavery. So these are the people he's talking to, and probably 2/3 of the Christian were slaves, maybe more. So he says, accept the authority of your masters with all, I'll say fear, because that's the Greek, but fear of the Lord, I think, is what he means. not only those who are kind and gentle, but those who are harsh. For it is a credit to you if, being aware of God, there's our phobos again, you endure pain while suffering unjustly. If you endure when you're beaten for doing wrong, what credit is that? But if you endure when you do right and suffer it, you have God's, well, the Greek is charis, God's grace supporting you. This is going to be the whole topic of the morning, so allow me to go over this quickly. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you. You slaves, some of you may have masters that are unkind. There's no way, if you're breaking from the system, you'd be crucified if you did break from it. So you're unlikely to do that. So you're in the system. You may be treated unkindly and harshly. And he just reminds them for a minute, don't forget what Jesus did, how he suffered unjustly too for you. It's possible to suffer even unjustly and still retain your freedom, your love, your goodness. And you don't have to either get yourself killed by trying to escape or, whatever. He left you an example so that you should follow in his steps. In living without rights, slaves represent the situation of the Christian community. That's why he points to them in particular, who are living without legal rights and, as he's already said, living as aliens and exiles among their neighbours. So the condition of the slave is a symbol, as it were, or a good example of how the Christian community as a whole is feeling in the alien environment in which they're living in that early early period. As in the previous passage, the motivation he's asking them to live their life, keep your goodness. No one can stop you loving, in other words. He doesn't want the injustice, and it's a terrible thing. Then they're powerless to do anything about it. And so he says, don't let them not only enslave you and treat you harshly, but actually kill your soul too. Stay who you are. The only effective result of insubordination on the part of a slave is crucifixion for the slave and for anyone else thought to be in collaboration with the slave. For a Christian slave to be insubordinate endangers the whole Christian community, whom they have just been asked to love. Nothing is to be gained by insubordination. By respecting the social order considered appropriate by their contemporaries, their suffering can be given a meaning. I think it's fairly useless for us to wonder why Peter mightn't have been interested in changing the system. It's too vast a question for us to go into now, and in his situation it may have been as unthinkable as it may have been in certain periods of our history to think of changing the whole institution. There's a timing for these things, and there's an appropriate timing, and that didn't exist then. Okay, the phrase, with all deference, places a limit on their acceptance. Their first obedience is to God. They cannot obey their master if it involves disobedience to God. And I think that's the point of that deference word, not to the master, but to God. So there are already limits on the obedience he's asking them to give. And if their master asks them to do something which is immoral or against their Christian values, they may have to, and some would have, even accepted death or crucifixion or martyrdom rather than give away their soul. But he doesn't want them, by disobedience, just to be disobedient, insubordination, to bring the whole Christian community into disrepute and disarray.